Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, today we begin our discussion of Peter Hessler's memoir, Country Driving, A Chinese Road Trip. Now, this is the last book that we will be discussing in our series, Around the World in Books. And if you've not yet purchased this book, you can obviously use Amazon.com, or you can go to abebooks.com and you can find them there. You can find great used copies, so you don't have to invest a lot of money. And like I've said several times, if you haven't bought the book yet, get it, start reading it, and come to China with me. I think it's going to be worth the trip. Now, I'm really thrilled to say that to introduce this book today, I have with me in the studio, via Skype, I have actually the author, Peter Hessler. And if you don't know much about Peter, let me just tell you a little bit about him. He is staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also a contributing writer at National Geographic magazine, and he's probably most well known for his China trilogy. And those three books are Chinatown and Oracle Bones, and we're using the third in the series, Country Driving. And I think Country Driving will give us more of a big overview of China, and I think that will help us get our minds focused on what really is happening in China. And I don't think all of us, probably in America or maybe even in all of the other Western countries listening in, we probably don't have maybe, let's say, as deep a view of what's going on in China as we should. So, Peter, welcome to JBL.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So today, basically what I do, Peter, is I just want to talk a little bit about you, yourself, and then I also want to know, well, the reason why you wrote the book, and then, of course, what we want to know most of all is we want to know about China that probably most of us will never have the opportunity to see firsthand. So that's my little roadmap. We'll call it like driving JBL. How about that?
Sounds good.
Okay. So I know a little bit of the background because, of course, I've done some reading on you. But maybe you could just start out and tell us how you came to be in China and why did you start writing about China?
Yeah, I mean, China wasn't something I thought about when I was young. I mean, you know, I grew up in – I was in high school in the late 1980s. And then I was in college from 88 to 92. And, you know, that was a time when it wasn't very common to study Chinese or to think about China. I grew up in Columbia, Missouri. So my horizons weren't really that far. I went to college on the East Coast and never took a class in Chinese or in Chinese history and really didn't have much interest in it. And of course, when I was in college was when the Tiananmen Square massacre happened in 1989. And that made it even less likely, I think, for Americans to really engage with China.
That's right. Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit about that later. And I'm sorry for interrupting, but go ahead.
Yeah, no. So I was focused, you know, what I really wanted to be was a writer. I originally thought I was going to go to graduate school, get a PhD, and maybe be a professor of literature, and write on the side, write fiction. So that was what I was planning to do. After college, I went to graduate school at Oxford University in England. And during those 2 years, I realized that I didn't want to go into academia, and I realized I didn't want to study literature anymore. I still wanted to write, though, and I wasn't sure how I was going to do that. And so I thought, well, let's take a long trip, see some of the world, and think about what the next step will be. And so I left England. That was in 1994, and I got a one-way plane ticket to Prague in the Czech Republic. And from there, I traveled overland, either by train or bus or eventually by boat. And I went to Russia, and then from Russia, I took the Trans-Siberian Railroad all the way from Moscow to Beijing, which was a seven-day trip, really an amazing experience. And so that was how I got to China. I was really just heading east, going home around the world in the wrong direction. and after China, I was planning to go to Southeast Asia. And really, I didn't have any intention to stay in China for very long because I heard from other travelers that it was a pretty tough place. But once I arrived in Beijing, and that would have been about August of 94, there was just a real tangible energy to it, and something about it really grabbed me. I mean, I just, you know, we had come from Russia. I was traveling with a friend, and our experience in Russia had been that the place felt pretty depressed. Those were tough times in Moscow. And we got to Beijing, and people were just, you could just see people were motivated, things were happening, and I got really fascinated. And I ended up spending about 6 weeks traveling on that trip. And by the end of that trip, I decided I want to come back to China. I want to live here. I want to try to learn the language. Now, I thought, you know, how can I do this? And so my decision was to join the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps had a new program in China at that point, and I was sent there as a volunteer. I was in the third group of volunteers. And so I was sent to a small town called Fuling in the interior of China along the Yangtze River. This was a town that, you know, hadn't had any American residents since the revolution of 1949.
Wow. Yeah.
So really isolated. There was one other American sent with me. And other than that, you know, we were on our own.
So you didn't know Chinese then before?
Not a word. No, I had not studied Chinese. And, you know, this is a disadvantage, but in some ways it's also, my mind was a great blank slate. I didn't have any prejudices about China, I think. I didn't have any real expectations. I didn't have fixed ideas of what the place should be. And in some ways that was very useful because things were changing very rapidly. The China that you would have studied in the 80s and early 90s was not the same China that I arrived in 1996. Yeah. So it was good to be sort of flexible. And the language came pretty quickly because, you know, I was in this town. There was one other native English speaker. and also because there were a few people in the town who could speak decent English. They learned it from listening to Voice of America and,
oh, wow,
you know, listening,
yes,
to tapes, and really impressive people. But they were actually, for political reasons, the Communist Party prevented them from hanging out with us. So, you know, if I was going to have any kind of social life, I had to learn Chinese. So I studied like crazy. And, of course, we had no internet connection either, so we had lots of time on our hands.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the thing is when I was in college, I did the literature degree, but I also took a minor in fine arts. And one of the classes that I took it on Chinese art, especially from the Ming Dynasty. So I was really fascinated by China. But it was one of those things that a lot of my friends were Jewish at that time. A lot of where I went, I started school, started the University of Pittsburgh at the Johnstown campus, and a lot of the students came from Philadelphia. A lot of the Jewish students came from Philadelphia, and we seemed to connect really well. And we all had the dream. This was in 75 of, you know, going and working on a kibbutz, you know. So, mm-hmm. So that would have taken me a much different direction than China. But I've always had this fascination with China and wanting to learn more about it. But it was kind of it seemed like a scary place, you know, to me. It's like, you know, in our minds, I think we had all these things floating around, you know, a little bit of fear of Mao. You know, and then
But I mean, it was a pretty tough place, and of course, you couldn't have gone in there in 1975 anyway. I mean, Americans didn't start to come until after the reforms began, and it really, you know, to be honest, I was very fortunate because even 5 years earlier, if I had gone to China, I couldn't have lived in a remote place like Fuling, and people wouldn't have been very open to me. There were still a lot of restrictions, but this was the first moment when you could actually kind of connect. And so I did end up, and I was there for 2 years in that town. I was able to learn the language and to make very good friends and really to get to know people on a very, very deep personal level. And so this wouldn't have been possible for people of an earlier generation.
No, it is really kind of amazing. That leads me to another question. We just got finished reading Thad Carhart's book, the Piano Shop on the Left Bank. I don't know if you're familiar with that book at all, but
no, I'm not actually. Is it about Paris? Or?
It's about Paris. Yeah, he was living in one of the small neighborhoods of Paris, and Thad is also a freelance writer. He worked in business like I did for years, and then he decided he wanted to break out on his own, And at one point, I tried to do that as well, and I was going broke, so I realized I better, you know, better not do this. But anyway, what he talks about in that book is he talks about how hard it is to make connection with the French, and it's not because, you know, they're just so snobbish or they're, you know, so uppity. It's just because, well, you know, they're just very respectful of people, and they're respectful of their private space. But he was able to break through the piano. And so that was like one of the big questions I think would be good for our listeners after we just finished this other book is, was it really hard for you to make connection with the people?
It's an interesting question. And I mean, Paris, the other thing about Paris is there's so many foreigners that go through Paris and so many tourists and so many expats who live there.
Yes.
That, you know, a French person is going to be less interested. I mean, the advantage that I had in a place like Fuling or really anywhere in China in the 90s was that there weren't many foreigners there and very few foreigners spoke Chinese. And so in the town where I lived, I mean, if I went to a shop or a restaurant, there was constantly a crowd following me, because people were so curious just to see a foreigner. So if I sat down at a noodle restaurant to have lunch, I might have a crowd of 20 people. That was really standard. Just watching, you know, and asking questions. And of course, at the beginning, I didn't really understand what they were saying. It was very frustrating. Sometimes it was intimidating, annoying. But, you know, over time, and as my Chinese improved, I realized, you know, these people, they're just really curious. They've been isolated from the world for decades. They just want to connect. They want to ask me questions, and I want to learn Chinese. And so they're here to teach me. You know, that was right. The way I looked at it. You know, like, let's relax. Don't assume that people are making fun of you or have negative, you know, intentions, and just do your best. And people were very patient with my bad Chinese, and my Chinese very quickly improved. And so once after about a year, you know, I was getting pretty good at spoken Chinese, and then it was really phenomenal because people were so interested in me as a foreigner, as an outsider. It was really quite easy to connect, and I would be invited to people's homes all the time, you know. And so it was the Chinese, in a way, even though they had this reputation for being closed, it was a moment when actually they were very open, because to them this was a unique opportunity to meet somebody from outside.
Well, it's really fascinating to hear that, because that would be my first impression is, well, if I went there, no one would want to talk to me anyway because I'm American or something like that. But I think it's funny in the book where you bring out, they didn't know what you were. Like, are you Mongolian? You know,
when I was driving, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Are you Mongolian? Yeah.
Yeah, no, and they'd ask if I was Uyghur, because the Uyghurs are Turkic people from the far west of China.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
When I was driving across northern China, I was in really remote areas, and these were tiny villages and places where no tourists ever go. And so it was really beyond their conception that a foreigner would show up there. And of course, I was driving a Jeep Cherokee by myself, and I was speaking Chinese. And this was when I lived in Beijing. So by this point, my Chinese was quite good. And so they really didn't. Yeah, I would often pick up a hitchhiker. You know, he or she would sit in the front seat of my car. We would talk for 5 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. And then finally, the person would kind of look at me and say very politely, are you Chinese? Or, you know, sometimes they say, you're not Chinese, are you? And so it wasn't even the first question. So that was an amazing experience. It made me feel much more connected to the place and much less like a foreigner.
Well, that's really fascinating. I know that, you know, I should say this. I had a similar experience, you know, because I was East Coast. You know what East Coast people are like. You know, Northeasterner. Mm-hmm. And then my wife and I had the opportunity when I had my first job, we went to Pendleton, Oregon. That was like, we were out there, you know, in the Wild West. You know, I was walking down the main street to go to work, and I had my little Irish cap on, and the cowboys and the Indians in the city were just stare at me, you know. And so, but I was American, but I still felt like a foreigner there. So, and they weren't as interested in, you know, learning about Shakespeare and books and all that either.
So. Yeah.
So did you learn to read Chinese as well?
Yes. You know, although my reading's not as good as my speaking, but it's, you know, I did a lot of newspaper. I really learned basically to read newspapers, because when I became a journalist, that was really important to me. I would have a lot of trouble getting through a novel.
Oh, I bet, yes.
But you know, each type of writing, you know, there's a fairly specific vocabulary to it, and so you can always expand and improve it. That's one of the things I would like to do when I I'll probably be living in China again in a couple of years, and I would like to sort of expand my reading abilities. Because once you have the basics of the language, it's not that difficult.
No, but I think for a writer, and I believe writing is one of the hardest jobs. And I've been doing it since I was 23. But I still think that learning like something like Chinese, and it's pictograph, so that is really going to give you a focus, and it's going to, I think, change the way you think, and it would really develop you as a writer to be able to do that. And
it was critical. I mean, and especially those 2 years that I spent in the small town in the Peace Corps, that's what really turned me into a writer. Part of it was that I gained this knowledge and some level of expertise, but a lot of it was just maturity. You know, I mean, one thing that you know as a writer, writers tend to develop over time. It takes a long time. You know, people don't tend to write very good stuff when they're 21, 22.
No.
And that's what's hard about it. It takes a lot of patience and a lot of commitment. As you mature, your voice becomes something different, and your sort of confidence and your knowledge, that's what shapes your writing. And that my experience in the Peace Corps accelerated that process. When I joined, I really wasn't ready to be a professional writer, and when I finished 2 years later, suddenly I was, and that's what I did from that point on.
I think one of the things I just wanted to ask a little bit, again, I'm just so curious about the Chinese people, but I have my own thoughts about the language, and here it's pictographic, and one of the other things I've been doing recently is, I've been working to learn French. Because one, it's just I would like to be able to read poetry in French, and then the other thing is, at one point I really was considering being an art student because I had done really well in high school and even I had early drawing classes when I was in college, and then I opted not to do that because I didn't think there was that much money in it, but it just seems like that the language and reading in Chinese would just give you a different view of the world. That's the way, when you're reading in pictures, to me, it has to be a different way of thinking to be able to, to comprehend what all those pictures mean and to keep that, that frame of mind. And I think, just wanted to ask you, do you think that really kind of affects the way they view the world there just because of their language and, the way they see things? It just seems to me that would really give them a different insight into what the world is or what the world should be.
Well, I think it makes a big difference in educational patterns, for example. I mean, because in order to learn Chinese, because it's not an alphabet, it's based on, it's a logographic system. So, you have to learn thousands of characters in order to be able to read. You basically need, you probably need about 3,000 characters to read newspaper pretty well. And to memorize those things, that's all it is it's rote memorization. So their education system is structured much more around memorization than ours is. And they apply that, they tend to apply that to other skills as well. And, in Country Driving, in my book, I describe going to a driving course, where Chinese who have never driven before suddenly have enough money to purchase cars. And so now they're learning how to drive, and you have to do a government sanctioned course for about a month to get your license. And it was really fascinating to watch how they taught driving, because it was really the same. It was just like teaching characters. You did certain moves with the car and you did them hundreds of times. And it really is not a good way to learn to drive, because you need to know that there's variables, that things aren't always predictable. But this pattern is a really fundamental educational pattern, and it comes from the characters. So it is true, I wouldn't have recognized that if I hadn't learned Chinese, I had just seen the way they structured this course as an outsider without any cultural background, it would all be kind of mysterious for me. But as somebody who had learned Chinese and as somebody who had worked in Chinese education, I immediately recognized what they were doing. And this is a strategy that they tend to apply to almost any new skill.
Right. When I worked at Westinghouse, I worked in a government contracts division and worked on the nuclear program. And we would bring one of the things they hired library science people to come in, and we built these huge databases so that we could document all of the engineering, writing and the let's say their reports and all that, and we would keyword them, and then we would put it into a computerized system. And we did hire Chinese librarians to come in because they were so effective at it. And
yeah.
And you could see it's a mindset, and the way they thought was just really amazing. And so
yeah. That's one reason why math is so strong also in China, because I think that educational strategy works much better for math, but it creates other weaknesses. And so I think there is a weakness in creativity, a weakness in spontaneity, that comes from this fairly rigid memorization based education system.
Yes. Although, one of the things, of course, I don't know if you've studied like the Ming art and all that, but some of the Ming, let's say the drawings, if you look at the artwork, of course, they're working in different mediums than we would do necessarily in the West. But I think, if you look at some of the drawings, I guess you'd call them paintings as well, they just have such a different look, but they're just absolutely exquisite, So I know there's one of my favorites is called Peach Blossoms, and it's you have the unique mountain environment there, and then you see all these beautiful almost reddish peach blossoms in it. So I just feel like the way we could get a better view of the world is not look at that culture as weird or strange, but it's just different, and language and the environment that I think in China also gives people a different view of the world as well. To me, it's just really fascinating. So when you were there, let's say when you first went to Yuling, what was the adjustment like for you? I mean, you came from a little bit of a higher tech world. I mean, and let's face it, in Western society, we can have just about anything we want when we want it. What was it like then to just go? Did you feel like you were going backwards in time? Did you feel like you were really deprived while you were there?
Well, it was the Peace Corps. And so I think when anybody who signs up for the Peace Corps is expecting a challenge and is expecting conditions that are not the same as we grew up with. And that's really one of the reasons you do it. I felt like it was an experience I wanted to have. And to be honest, I first applied in college and I was going to be sent to Africa. And then I got a fellowship to go to Oxford. So I canceled my Peace Corps application. And by the time I reapplied, I went to China. And so, you have the image of the African mud hut as sort of the classic Peace Corps experience. And in a way, China was much more advanced. I was teaching at a college. My students had studied English for 7 years. They often had trouble speaking it because they had not met native speakers, but they were bright kids, and I had a nice, a perfectly comfortable apartment. And I mean, nowadays it would probably seem pretty rough to me, but I wasn't complaining, and the food was phenomenal. I mean, this was a pretty poor area, so you had no variety. Nowadays you would have Western restaurants and Korean restaurants and Japanese in a town, but in those days it was only Sichuanese food. But the Sichuanese cuisine is amazing, and the Chinese cuisine is incredibly resourceful. And so even in areas that are relatively poor, the food tastes great. There's not a lot of meat in it necessarily, but they use vegetables and they use spices. And so, to be honest, we were all kind of happy that we felt like we had lucked out, and we all kind of laughed about the poor volunteers who were living without electricity or whatever.
Right,
so the
right.
conditions were, the thing that made China difficult was not physical or technological conditions. The thing that made it difficult was the language and the culture and the politics. This was a place that had been, first of all, it's quite radically different linguistically and culturally than the West. It's been closed, basically for, 30 some odd years. The country had been incredibly closed, and so people didn't really know how to respond to foreigners. And the political system was still pretty repressive in a town like Fuling, and so the Communist Party, was pretty rigid on the campus where I taught. And so these were all things that you had to adjust to. So, in for the typical Peace Corps volunteer, there was a big physical challenge. China was not a physical challenge, but it was an intellectual challenge.
Yeah, that's so good to hear. I mean, it's good to know because, that I think that's most of Western view is like we have this fear of Mao. What was communism like? And I think that would be a big challenge for those of us that have lived, like I say, in America, because we've had so many freedoms.
Yeah, you know, it was difficult to, you know, and you know, for example, the textbooks that I taught from were, you know, basically pieces of propaganda. And so I was teaching about American culture from a textbook that really described America in very negative terms. And it was really frustrating to try to teach from this. And so, you know, part of my job was to sort of undermine that book and to find ways to resist its message, you know, and I had to learn to be resourceful there. But yeah, you know, that this was the communist system really had damaged people's minds and had damaged the intellectual environment. But there was, you know, a recovery was happening. That recovery is not complete, of course, but it is, you know, I do think over time Chinese people have become much more aware and much more open. And it was inspiring to see my students start to ask questions and start to connect with things that we were teaching them.
So I know I just I pulled up one of your more current articles about your censor when you're traveling as a journalist, and I have to say that I just have really enjoyed reading Country Driving, and for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's really witty, but I think it's immensely you know, educational. But I think it's so humorous, especially, you know, that whole book one where you talk about driving China and you insert or inset the questions from the driving test.
These were just amazing questions.
That's why I wanted to ask, is that real? I mean, you didn't make that up.
These are direct questions. I mean, I can give you some examples. I mean,
give us some more examples. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, here's an example. Here's a question. You know, this is the driving exam that you have to take in order to get a license. And one of the questions is, if another motorist stops to ask you directions, you should A, not tell him. B, reply patiently and accurately. C, tell him the wrong way. Yeah. You know, here's another example. If you come to a road that has been flooded, you should A, accelerate so the motor doesn't flood. B, stop, examine the water to make sure it's shallow and drive across slowly. Or C, find a pedestrian and make him cross ahead of you. You know, so, you know, it's very funny. I mean, you know, the thing about China is it is a very funny place. You know, it's, and all of my books about China have a lot of humor in it because I really couldn't write about it any other way. I mean, it's partly how you deal with the place in one sense. And also it's just accurate. This is what it is. And Chinese people laugh at the same things. I mean, this book that you're reading, Country Driving, has been published in Chinese, and it's sold more copies in China than it's sold in America. And the Chinese get it. They like they know these questions are ridiculous. So it's not as if the joke's on them or something. I mean, they know. I mean, this is a government bureau that put together this test, and they did it in a totally bureaucratic and nonsensical way. And everybody in China recognize it. This is the kind of thing that happens in a hidebrown political system. So they find it very funny, you know, just as much as we would.
Oh, that's great. You know, it's funny because here in Oklahoma, you know, we're subject to this. I mean, violent conditions. You know, of course, you know, in the Northeast, we used to have all the snow. We don't get much snow here, but we have to deal with our tornadoes. And then we could have drought in the summer, and then early spring, it's like flooding. And people still don't know how not to drive through an intersection flooded with water. I mean, it's like they need to take this driving test.
I can remember as a kid, I grew up in Missouri, and one year we were driving somewhere in Iowa, and it must have been Nebraska. And when the river was flooded, the Missouri River up there, and my father put me on the hood of the car.
Yeah.
to guide, you know, because the river was flooding the road. So I would, and I was telling him whether he needed to go a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right. So that was a Midwestern approach to this problem. It was very similar to what somebody in China would do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's awesome. So the thing is, I mean, my wife and I, has taught middle school English, and every now and then she'll come on the radio with me on the panel. But she's really thoroughly enjoying reading the book, and she'll you know, knock me in the head and say, "Did you read this? This is hilarious!" You know, so we you know, after training our four daughters on how to drive, and now we have grandchildren coming online that want to drive. So we're gonna use this with them and see what their answers are.
It's a good. Unfortunately, my Chinese license has expired. I have I have a valid Egyptian license, which is another type of adventure. But
I want to talk to you about Egypt before
we get out. My Chinese one is unfortunately past date. So when we move back, I'll have to go through all this stuff again.
Oh, man. So, yeah, I want to talk to you about Egypt before we're done here today. But one of the things, since we're on this whole thing with China, I mean, can people from the West, like, go to China now and really meet the people from the East, and can they make a connection? Would they have to go there, like, in the Peace Corps situation and live like you lived, or?
No, there's lots of ways. I mean, it's much easier now than it was. You know, when I did that, that was 20 years ago, you know, and mm-hmm. more than 20 years ago now. And so, I mean, I'm amazed now how many Americans are studying Chinese. There's many more schools that offer Chinese at quite early age, and there's a lot of American students studying abroad in China. It's not difficult to do. I think the thing about, you know, we tend to conflate a lot of the cultures in this part of the world, you know, and I think there's often sort of a confusion with Japan. For example, Japanese culture is a very complicated, it's very formal, it's very difficult for foreigners. You know, the physical conditions in Japan are quite good, and, you know, technology is really impressive there, and cities run very well. But it's a tough place to really be accepted as a foreigner. It's you know, this is an island culture, and it's very formal. And I have good friends who speak beautiful Japanese, and it's, you know, for all of them, it's a struggle to be accepted there. China is not like that. You know, this is, I think Americans have this idea, oh, in China, if you say the wrong thing, you're going to offend somebody. Well, that's true in Japan. That's not true in China, you know. Yes. The Chinese are I always found them somewhat similar to Americans in terms of the informality and the flexibility. It's kind of hard to offend people there. If, you know, they'll just blow it off if the foreigner said the wrong thing or whatever. And so, you know, I think that's the important thing for Americans to realize, is that this isn't – it's really not as intimidating as it looks. And this is – especially during this moment, the Chinese have learned to be very flexible. They've made this incredible economic improvement, and they have not done that by following the same old traditions. They've made that improvement by learning to be open to outside things and learning to be open to outsiders. So, you know, I think it's in some ways you know, a welcoming, surprisingly open place. And so young people who go there often have that experience. The other thing about China is it's incredibly safe. There's very little crime there. You can't send, for example, an 18-year-old girl to many parts that we wouldn't want to send an 18-year-old girl to travel alone in Egypt, for example, right. Where I was. Right. But you can do that in China. There's no problem at all.
Wow.
You know. So it's a you know, I think it's a good time for young people to go there.
Yeah. Well, I think that I think why this book is so good and so helpful is that it you know, the more people that will read it, and I know you just said you're not on Twitter and Facebook, and we've been running, you know, special tweets about it. We're quoting from the book, and then, you know, just giving people, it really encouraged them to read it. It's kind of like we're selling for you. But the thing is, I just feel like, I mean, if I look at myself, I have kind of a distorted view of what goes on. I mean, like I said, you know, you're half afraid of Mao, and then we know a little bit about Deng Xiaoping, and now we have Xi Jinping, and, you know, he looks like a friendly Western guy. But then we hear on the news, you know, about, you know, that the China's ready to get into a trade war with the U.S., you know, kind of thing. And so I think it's good to kind of get a little bit more background. And I think, you know, having you do what you did, I want to talk to you more about that a little bit, but having you do what you did can kind of open up our kind of like our views of things. So, yeah. So, you know, we talked a little bit about driving, and here, you know, you're driving China, and I just think it just showed a lot of courage on your part, not only to get the driving license, but then to, you know, rent a Jeep in Beijing and knowing that you weren't allowed to take it out anyway, but you did. And I think the whole scene in there when you're camping at night, you're way off the road, you're out by yourself, and then you feel like this light is coming in the tent, and it's the moon, You know, I think that was a great scene. You're afraid you're going to get caught by the thought police or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, because at the time I did this trip, you weren't allowed to drive alone, like a journalist, as a journalist. But I, you know, I realized the way the system worked was that the only way they track you is basically through the hotels, because every time you register in a hotel, you have to show your passport, and your passport says, you know, my visa said that I was a journalist, and they're supposed to report that to the local police. And so I knew that if I registered at hotels, I was going to be sent back to Beijing. And so my solution to that was just to bring a tent and to camp, and that worked great. You know,
I thought it was awesome. Yeah.
You know, I didn't have to register, and nobody knew where I was, you know, and then periodically I'd go through a bigger city, and in a bigger city, you know, it's not a problem to go to the hotel. Nobody's going to care. And so, yeah, it was great. And the other thing, I mean, those landscapes are really amazing. I mean, northern and western China are stunningly beautiful. It's, you know, somewhat analogous to the, you know, the west of America. You know, you have these incredible open landscapes and beautiful deserts and mountains. And so, I really enjoyed that. It was a wonderful trip.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the process of the book. I mean, of course, you know, I have the writing background, and, you know, I always try and keep journals, and I keep trying to, you know, make notes. I was just at a lecture the other night, and I was making notes because I thought there were some great ideas I'd like to build on. But how did you do it? I mean, if you're out driving on the wall and you get so many details in there, what was the process you used? Did you keep a journal?
Oh, yeah. No, you always have to take notes, and you take notes as quickly as you can. I had my computer with me. I'm usually writing in my notebook, you know, so if I see something interesting, I pull over and write it down, or I take a picture of it. Mm-hmm. When I had, you know, a lot of what I was doing was picking up hitchhikers. And so I would talk with the hitchhiker while I was driving. And then after I dropped the hitchhiker out, I would, you know, pull over to the side of the road and transcribe our conversation. You know, I couldn't take notes while driving, while talking, but I would immediately do that. And then I would type them into my computer as quickly as possible. Because you know, I always realized the notes are, you know, you can't do this without the detailed notes, because you simply don't remember enough over the long term. So you have to record things immediately and get them into a computer, you know, into a word processor. And then later when you go through all that material and you figure out the structure of your book and how you're going to write it. But you need all of those details, the signs, the way people's faces look, what they said, their quotes. So, you know, nowadays it's even easier because now I use a digital recorder often.
Right.
When I took this trip, this was before, you know, we sort of had smartphones and those kind of recorders.
Exactly. But one of the things I try and get across to my, I teach a sophomore English language literature, and I always want to tell them, I said, look, do you realize we just read a really good book by Robert Seethaler. He's a German, he's actually he's from Austria. He wrote this great little book. It's kind of like in a Hemingway-esque, and it was called A Whole Life. And it's 147 pages, and they're thinking this was an easy book to write. And I said, it wasn't easy. I said, he had to plan every little detail of that. And so I'd like our listeners to know that when you do something like country driving, there was a lot of background work that had to go into that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's all, you know, on the ground research, and then the drive was only one third of it, and there's two other sections, and each of those I'm doing a lot of intense reporting and managing my notes, and then sitting down and figuring out the structure before I even start to write.
Yeah, so now that you bring up the other sections, I my impression is that, of course, to me the first section is the most humorous, but then it's like when you start talking about the movement of the peoples from the land, you know, off the land, and you have, you know, the scenes and the descriptions of, you know, the parents that go off to work in the cities and the factories, but they leave their children, you know, with their grandparents. To me, it just seems like China might be moving forward. We know they've moved forward economically. I mean, that's in the news all the time. But the thing is China like now going through what the West did with the Industrial Revolution? I mean, there's a like economic advantage, but is it hurting Chinese family?
Yeah, I mean, this is the Industrial Revolution compressed, you know, so everything's happening at a much faster pace. And, you know, so when I was driving on this trip and stopping in small villages in the north, I would very rarely see anybody of working age. I mean, the people you see in the village are the old people, and then you see the small children, because when the migrants, there's 150 million migrants in China, people who have left the rural areas to go work in the factory towns of the south and the east. And when they go to those towns, they usually don't bring their children. And so the children are raised by grandparents. And so you go to these villages, and it's very, you know, it's really a powerful, striking, you know, phenomenon that you, that there's nobody who's of working age, and it's just old people and kids. And the villages are just emptying out. So, you know, when I, the second part of this book, I'm in one of these villages that has lost most of its population. You could, I could hike up, I rented a house there for years, and you could hike up the mountain to go to a, you know, a very small village that was totally abandoned, and these houses are just empty, and you know, it's a really powerful image, and it, you know, it's one that's recognizable. If you look back at Victorian, you know, literature and poetry, there, it's full of descriptions of villages that are emptying out, and you know, the same thing happened in our society. So this is, you know, this is China's turn, basically.
Yes. Well, what did you have access to, like, the grandparents raising the kids? I mean, if here we are, my wife and I are in our mid 60s. We have 9 grandchildren. Our youngest daughter is actually in labor today. They have our 9th grandchild, but we just say we would not want to go back. I mean, our oldest granddaughter is 15. I said we would not want to go back, and if we had to, obviously we would, but we wouldn't want to go back and try and raise our grandchildren.
So, yeah, no, I mean, it's I don't know, I think for an American, it's not something that you want to do in your, you know, in your 60s and 70s. The Chinese don't have a choice. You know, this is the, you know, the task of a generation. And it's especially poignant because those people who are in their 60s and 70s in China who are raising these kids, these are people that really lived through the tough years of the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, the really bad political years. They saw serious poverty. And this is the first time in their lives where they have some physical comfort, they have some financial stability, but now they have to raise kids again, you know? So you really feel for those people, you know, but this is, you know, societies undergo massive change and they have to adjust, and you don't hear people in China complaining. You know, I mean, it's people are very tough there. You know, they're determined to make the best of it. I admired that. I mean, I feel like it's one of the things coming back to America that I feel like maybe we've lost a little bit of that. I feel like we've gotten a little bit soft.
I think so. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I think I would even go a little bit further and say we're a little bunch of whiners. You know, I mean,
yeah, we're a little spoiled. You know, and when you live in a place like China, I think you feel this very powerfully because they aren't. You know, they're tough. You know, the Chinese phrase is "chikhu," which is to eat bitter, bitterness. Yes. And people are willing to do that.
Yes, well, you know, my parents were kids in the Depression, and so I mean, we didn't have a lot growing up. We had enough. You know, I was Irish Catholic family. There were 7 siblings. So, you know, I remember going to school with cardboard in the holes of my shoes, but we didn't care. Everyone else was the same way.
And I think that's true. Yeah.
But now if kids don't have what their Nikes or their New Balance or, you know, and it's like, they just can't handle it. They're like freak out kind of thing.
So, yeah, I mean, this is one of the benefits of living overseas or traveling overseas is it gives you a little more perspective on your own society as an American, I feel very grateful for what we have and a lot of advantages here, but I also feel like these things are not guaranteed and you know, it is a competitive world, and you know, we can't sort of, you know, for example, one of the great advantages we have is our education system. I think in some ways we don't value that enough. We're not investing in that enough.
Right. I agree.
And the Chinese don't, you know, they've made that a top priority. You know, I think we can learn something from them.
Well, I think even the testing in the United States shows that American students are falling behind. They're falling behind in math, science, and, You know,
and part of it, we have to push the values. I mean, one thing, when I taught in China in the 90s, most of my students were from the countryside, and they were from families that usually had never had anybody go to college. Almost all of them had no college, experience in their families. And most, quite a few of them had parents who were illiterate. But the amazing thing in China is that even an illiterate parent, or even a parent who has a very poor education, is able to emphasize the importance of education to their child. So even these students I had whose parents, couldn't even read, those parents were still able to communicate, this is important. Yes. You need to learn this so that you're not stuck in a field or in a rice paddy like I am.
Yes.
I feel like sometimes in America we don't, that communication isn't so much there.
Right.
Especially in communities that have, that have had a lot of educational failure, or have not had, the benefits of good education, it's a lot harder for them to tell their children, you need to do this. Somehow the Chinese are able to do it. It's probably because of Confucianism. It's a deep cultural tradition that they have. And yes. It kind of saved them, I think, from, even though they did so much damage in the Cultural Revolution and in the tough years of Maoism, this ancient tradition survived. And that's what's helped them. It's one of the things that really helped them pull their way out.
Yes, if you look, like I said, when I studied Chinese art, if you look at some of the, even the pottery of the Ming Dynasty, they had such an emphasis on high quality. It's just amazing what they produced. And, I teach, college sophomores, and, sometimes you can see that there are things left out of the education. When I was in school, I went to a college prep high school. We were really forced through the grist mill to learn certain things, and it really was to prepare us for college. And I feel like some of our students, they've actually come in that they have the good SAT scores, but they really aren't really prepared to do the really hard work. And you especially learn that when you get into Shakespeare,
There's stuff that, that the Chinese have too much memorization, but we have too little at this point. That all of American students would memorize poems and things. I think that's actually very important. I have my daughters can recite Shakespeare. They're six. They can recite William Blake poems. I think it helps your learning. We've gone too far away from that, I believe. The Chinese are way on the other extreme, and I think they need to reform in the opposite direction. But for me, the ideal is somewhere between those two systems.
Yeah, it's even gotten the same way in Britain. I was just we just had a lecture from a journalist from Britain come in, and I was had the opportunity to talk a little bit about Shakespeare. And one of the things I do with my sophomore students, instead of giving them a final paper, I make them memorize a soliloquy, and then they have to recite it for me. That's like 50% of their final, because they don't know how to do that anymore.
I think it's something that we should be doing in elementary school.
I
did some of it, not as much as I wish I had, but I've had my daughters do it because I just think it's good for you. And also just you're gaining the texture of the language. It's right. A more intimate feeling for some of these touchstones of the culture.
Yeah. And see, I think when I was, of course, I was in, I started at my college in 70, so I was still at a good time. I went to, Pitt at that time was semi-private. I don't know if you knew that, but, they did, they had a language. We had to take a language, we had to take logic. If you're going to be a literature major, you had to have the required class of Shakespeare, and you had to pass it with a certain grade to get a degree, and I think that's also going from our universities. Well, it's just a little too hard. So we'll push them through.
It's interesting. In my experience, because I did a creative writing degree as an undergraduate, and then I went to Oxford, and I did the very traditional Oxford course where you do each period in literature and you have to do Shakespeare. I had to do Spencer. I had to do Middle English and learn to translate Gawain the Green Knight. And it's the kind of thing that an American student would groan at, but I found it to be actually an incredibly valuable experience. And a lot of it stayed with me. I mean, I still remember quite a bit because I was forced to do it in such a systematic, traditional fashion.
Yes. Well, we had to do Chaucer, and I also studied 16th and 17th century. So we did a lot of John Donne. I mean, those were required things to do. And, yeah. You know, it really does benefit you as a writer, by the way, you know, to learn those things and to learn the language and all that. So, well, the thing is, we're getting close to the end, but the thing is, I just wanted to ask you a few more questions, Peter, and are there any things that you left out of the book, Country Driving, that you wish you had left in the book?
Oh, I can't. No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, this was my third book in China. And so, you know, and at the end of more than a decade, I lived in China for 11 years. And so I really felt like, you know, I was pretty experienced at this point. And so, you know, I had a very strong idea about what kind of reporting I wanted to do, what kind of information I wanted to learn, and how to convey it. So, I can't say that I have any regrets. You know, it was a great experience to research and write the book. I just feel fortunate that I was there at that time and was in a position to do it.
Yeah, well, that's, again, my wife and I just want you to know we're thoroughly enjoying it. And, you know, we do have a 60-plus panel. We call it 60 plusers. You know, we're all over 60. So So we get together and we get to read literature and then talk about it on the radio. But one of our writers here, he does follow Asia. And I know he's planning to go to Beijing this summer. And I actually asked him, I said, hey, do you want to read this book with us? So he's actually going to come on the radio with us. And he studies, you know, what's going on in, you know, China, Japan, and you know, so. So it's really kind of interesting. So I know you were in Cairo, and I know you were reporting on the, you know, what was going on with the Arab Spring and the revolution over there. So is there going to be a Country Driving Egypt?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what I'm doing right now.
Oh, wow.
You know,
that's great.
So I, you know, I was in Egypt from 2011 to 2016 to last summer.
Wow.
So 5 years there. And yeah, I mean, it was a really intense, fascinating time to be there.
Yeah.
Very different from China, both politically and culturally. I studied Arabic there, and that was a great experience. I just had a story in The New Yorker 2 weeks ago about my experiences studying Arabic. And so now I'm working on a book about Egypt, and it's partly about those political events, but really more about, you know, culture and what grassroots life is like in Egypt. So
that's great. Yeah, well, we're looking forward to it. I think that now that we've met and talked, I've went ahead and I bought all the trilogy for China, and I just bought your latest one as well. And you know,
Strange Stones. That's
Strange
a collection
Stones.
Of,
yeah,
of collection. Essays, yeah, about both China and the U.S. Yeah.
So I'm going to be doing a lot more writing. I just actually developed a whole new class on Shakespeare, on Shakespeare's tetralogy from Richard II to Richard III. And so I there's some lessons in there I think we could learn in society today. So I'm going to start doing a lot more writing on that as well this summer.
Yeah, well, in my first book, I just, you know, because I was teaching literature in the Peace Corps in that small town in China. And so I taught Shakespeare and my students performed the plays. And that was, you know, an incredible experience. And so I have a couple of chapters about that in Rivertown, my first book.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading that. So, okay, well, it looks like we're running out of time. And Peter, just thank you for sharing your time with us. And like I said, we'll probably do some more on the radio, and we'll let you know that we're going to do that. So next time, the 60-plus panel will be joining me to discuss the fun, witty, and immensely informative book, Country Driving, A Chinese Road Trip by Peter Hessler. So I would very much like to hear what you have to say about Country Driving. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.